I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Labor Day is Monday, and this hour we are going to pay tribute to the mind of the American worker. Our guest this hour has written a wonderful book that's now in its 10th anniversary edition, The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. Mike Rose writes, there are about 2 million waitresses in the U.S. Through a combination of physical and social skill and the ability to think on their feet, they support families, put kids through school, pay for their own school, or help aging parents. There are 2 million home health care workers in our country. There are somewhere around 1.5 million plumbers, carpenters, and electricians daily clearing the flow of water, completing a circuit, building and repairing our shelter. And of course, the list continues. Ranch hands, farm workers, long-haul truckers, local drivers, firefighters, miners, welders, untold numbers of people who work in factories, canneries, and meat processing plants. They are so present, their mental and manual abilities so woven, he writes, into our daily lives that their skills are taken for granted. Well, he's not going to let those skills slip out of sight. That's why he wrote Mind at Work, to pay homage to the ability of the American worker and to also pay homage and to document all of their abilities, including their mental abilities. Mike Rose is our guest. Mike is the son of Italian immigrants. Over the last 40 years, he's taught in all kinds of educational settings, kindergarten to job training to adult literacy programs. He's on the faculty of the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. He has written 11 books on education, language, literacy, and cognition. And Studs Terkel, one of our favorite people who wrote Working so many years ago, said of Mike's book, it's an eloquent tribute to our working men and women. It knocked me out. We would love to hear from you, the workers, this hour of the program about the jobs that you do and the mental skill that it takes in addition to the physical skill it may take. Tell us about your jobs and how you use your minds and how important your job is to your life. Our phone number this hour, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Mike, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for writing about this subject. Well, we have to start with your mother, Rosie, because it seems to me as though she taught you everything you know.
Right. Well, my mother was a career waitress. She has a story that's not unlike a whole lot of other stories of women of her generation. She had to quit school in the seventh grade to care for a bunch of younger siblings, and waitressing turned out to be the kind of work that she could do, and she got to be very good at it. And as I said, she did it all our lives, and she kept food on the table and kept a roof over our heads. And I learned about what she did when I was a kid, Kathleen, because I'd go to the restaurant where she worked. I'd take the bus and go downtown Los Angeles, and my father and I, who was ailing, we'd sit at the lunch counter or we'd sit in the back booth and we'd watch her do what she did. Mm. And I was always, even as a kid, you know, I was just amazed at how she could handle all that and seem to remember everything and not miss a beat. And so you're right. The mind at work starts with my mother, Rosie.
Mm-hmm. And also dealing with all of the various personalities, the customers, sensing what their mood, I mean, she's part psychologist too, what their mood may be if the cook woke up on the wrong side of the bed and you're going to have to deal with, you know, orders you want quickly and maybe they're not there as fast as they should be. There's so many elements to the job.
Right. So of course, you put your finger on it, right? There's all the physical requirements. And then there's the mental stuff that I talk about, the memory and the prioritizing the tasks, you know, what to do first, what to do second. But as you say, a restaurant's a really emotional place as well. People are coming in with all kinds of different feelings, and, you know, all the way from just wanting to get something to eat, to being in a hurry, to being irritable, to wanting to flirt. I mean, you name it. You got all you got that going on. And then there's your other waitresses. There's the cook. There's the manager. If you have to return a dish, which is not uncommon, how's the cook going to take that? How do you navigate that? How do you read your customers? You know, how do you tell what kind of mood they're in? There's so much that goes on in a restaurant that I think goes unnoticed.
Mm-hmm. And then she would come home, and you talk about putting that towel on the bed, and she would pour the tip money out.
Yeah. It's so funny, Kathleen, that, I mean, I was just a kid, a little boy, and that I can still visualize. Mm. It was an old, I guess they used to call them tea towels, you know, just like in a dish towel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was white, but it had turned sort of silver gray just from the tips that she would pour onto. So she would pour tips out every night and count them out. And, you know, it was those tips, as I said, that kept food on the table for us. So that towel is a very vivid, it's a very vivid memory for me, because I guess it represented us staying afloat.
And there's no doubt that she felt valued by you and her family. Did she feel valued by society at large and by the people she worked for?
Well, what is so interesting about the kind of work my mother did, and I think a lot of career waitresses would tell you this, on the one hand, they get pretty irritated by the way that society in general tends to sometimes look upon them. You know, waitressing is classified as very low-skilled work by the Department of Labor. And I think in the general public, people figure that, anybody can be a waitress, and if you sort of can't do anything else, that's what you do. Or college kids do it over the summer. So on the one hand, there was that sometimes that offense that would be taken. On the other hand, the work meant a great deal to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, here was a woman with a seventh-grade education, and she was able to have a great deal of independence because she was very good at what she did. And as she put it to me one time, she said, you know, I just knew I could always get work. So there was a sense of independence, but she also got great pride. There was great pride in what she referred to as being among the public, because as she put it, not everybody can do that. So she was very proud of her social skills as well, not only her ability to handle a restaurant at rush hour, but just the kind of smarts that she had about people. And she was very smart about people.
Mm-hmm. And yet we as a society, you obviously have been on a mission for a long time to change this, don't think of people like your mom, people who are in that field, who are home health care workers, who are non-college educated, and the thrust more and more is you got to go to college, that we tend to lump many of those people as being perhaps unskilled people or people who are not very well educated, when right. So we're not paying attention to their minds. And holy Toledo, talk to somebody who does plumbing work or does car mechanics. Oh my gosh, I think about the minds of the people who are doing that. I can't even begin to understand how they do what they do.
Well, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was to get at that very thing you're talking about. This is a funny thing in a society that is built on democratic principles and that has this strong anti-aristocratic bias all the way back to its founding. Given all that, we still make pretty sharp distinctions about people based on the work they do. So if people do blue-collar or service work, if they get their hands dirty, there's this assumption sometimes that they're just not as sharp as the folks who are wearing white collar and, you know, dressing up in a suit and going off to an office. And so one of the things I wanted to get at was to disrupt, to unsettle that kind of easy set of assumptions that we make. We don't even know we make them, I think. It's so inbred.
Mm-hmm. And we classify people, too, don't we, early on? I know you've worked with students of all ages. Those who are bright, you're going on to college. We identify them. And those who are not, well, maybe we can get you some vocational training, or we'll work with what you have. It may not be much, but we'll help you along.
And that was, you know, for many, many years, that was built into the high school. I mean, those of us of a certain age remember very well the kind of rigid curricular tracks that existed when you went into high school, and based on some kind of a placement test, usually an IQ test or something, you would be slotted right then and there into the college preparatory track or kind of just general track or into the vocational track. So, you know, right at that early age, we were making these pretty consequential judgments about people in terms of how smart we thought they were and therefore what kind of work they could do. And what's interesting is, of course, that the judgment that we made was based on sometimes just a single test taken on a single day.
Mm-hmm.
And it had consequences for, you know, the next 4 years of people's high school career and then what would happen after that.
Mm-hmm. And yet we have so many examples in our history. I know you pay attention to women who entered the workforce in large numbers during World War II, who were doing welding work, who were working. My mom was working at an airport, you know, helping with planes landing and not landing them, but air traffic control. All of these jobs that now you have all this training for, and people learned on the job, didn't have education in an area, but boy, did they step up to the plate.
Yeah, and we see that all the time, don't we? You know, people who, you know, sort of have a certain position or a certain role in society, and then some kind of a crisis happens. And, you know, actually this happens within families as well as happens within society. And then something happens, some kind of a crisis happens, and then boom, suddenly these folks move into positions that they were never thought to be capable of handling,
mm-hmm.
and they do a terrific job. And you're right, World War II presented a really interesting kind of national example of that with the way women moved so powerfully into the male workforce.
So you had a chance to travel for many, many years all over the country, and you had a chance to observe workers in all kinds of fields, as well as learning about education, because you're an education guy. What stories really struck you beyond your family stories? We want to get to your uncle, too, but who did you feel was particularly undervalued? Maybe it's too many people to even mention, particularly undervalued in our society.
Yeah, I can. Let me just say a word about the first part of what you said, because it's such a wonderful story, and I love to tell it, and I'll make it brief. But,
sure.
But you're right, I traveled around and spent untold hours sitting with people or standing by and watching them while they did their work, whether it was, you know, in a machine shop or a beauty salon, and would talk to them. Sometimes if I could talk to them while they were working, I could. If that was not possible, then I'd talk to them afterwards. You know, if I take pictures or draw sketches or take notes and be able to talk to them. And then I talk to other people who did that kind of work to kind of get their take on it. So just doing research for the Mind at Work turned out to be a remarkable experience, Kathleen. And I think if I had to pick one category of work that surprised me the most, and here's where my biases are going to come out, the category that surprised me the most, and this is solely because of my ignorance, was hairstyling.
Oh.
I guess, you know, like so many people, I kind of bought the stereotype, right, that, you know, oh, hairstyling, that's no big thing. That's just, you know, the beauty products and this and that. Well, oh, my gosh. Did
I know. right.
Wow. The kinds of knowledge that a good hairstylist has to have, and the skill and the aesthetic sense and the interpretive abilities.
Mm-hmm.
I was so struck by, you know, if you asked me one moment I could tell you, it would be this one. I was sitting in a salon, and a client comes in and flops down in the chair and says to the stylist, I don't know, just give me something kind of light and summery.
I thought,
wow, that's about as vague and poetic as you can get, right? And
right.
The stylist, very systematically, she started asking questions, and then she started sort of fooling around with the woman's hair in the mirror so they could both see what they were doing. She kept asking her questions. She would ask her to clarify if she would say 2 inches, what she'd make her hold up her hand and show what she meant by 2 inches. She would grab magazines and show her some pictures. She would do all these different things. And at the end of it, was able to create a style that this woman really liked and execute it. So I was just flabbergasted at the kind of intellectual chops it took to do what that stylist did.
Right. Oh, I agree with you. And then it's just such an artistic form. They really are artists, people who are in hairstyling.
Yeah.
So artistic. Well, my mom always used to say, you know, Kathy, your hair is your crowning glory. And so whenever she wanted me to have, but it's true, it's your crowning glory. And they do all kinds of other things as well. Plus, you know, the physical demands of that job, to stand on your feet all day. If you talk to stylists, you have to wear certain kinds of shoes or you run into knee problems. That's hard work.
Yeah, a lot of them end up developing back and knee problems. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. Mike Rose is our guest, and he's written, obviously, it's now in its 10th anniversary edition, so it's a book that will be around always because it's poetic and it's important, and it does remind you of Studs Terkel's interviews with working people and his body of work that really celebrated the people who are among us every day, who are doing jobs every day. It's The Mind at Work, and Mike has a new preface for the 10th edition, which has just come out in paperback. The subtitle is Important, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. We can move in all kinds of directions here. I'm sure that there are many of you as we approach Labor Day who would like to talk about the work that you do and how you use your mind. And maybe you're in a field where we don't think that you where it's mostly physical, but you'll prove us wrong and talk about how you have to use your mind at work. We can move into this whole area of vocational education because we frequently talk about education and some are saying, well, not everybody's set for college. We need to give more money to our tech schools. What is the role of vocational education in our society now? And here's how you join us. As we celebrate Labor Day a little bit early, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Mike is the son of Italian immigrants, and for 40 years now, he's taught everything from kindergarten to job training, adult literacy programs. He's on the faculty right now of the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, and he's written 11 books, including Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Unprepared, Possible Lives, The Promise of Public Education in America, Why School, Reclaiming Education for All of Us, and Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. All right, I'm looking forward to talking with you, and we'll do so in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike Rose is our guest, and our phone lines are just humming, which is great. People want to talk about what they do, and we're ready to listen. Let's start our calls with David in Belgium, Wisconsin. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Yes, this subject really touches a nerve with me because for the past 37 years, I've made my living as a truck driver, and over the road and local and whatever. And for years, I come from a fairly large family, and my some gone to college, some not, some in the trades. But for years, people have said to me, oh, you got to get out of that. You got to go to school, get an education. And then trucking was something I started very young with my dad when I was 16, 17. I've been doing it since I was about 18 or 21 years, you know, very young. But anyway, the trades in this country are so belittled right now. My oldest brother went to college, and he finished college, and we were sitting there one day at my parents' place, and he said to me, you got to get out of that job, he says, because you got to get yourself an education. And he threw the Wall Street Journal at me, and he said, why don't you read that? You might learn something. And I thought that was incredibly hurtful to me, and I said, look, you know, he's been the one that's been in and out of work for the past 25, 30 years, and I've been married for 31 years. I married a wonderful gal. I put her through school. I've got three sons. They all went to college. They're all doing well. And you know how I did that was from driving a truck. Every time you see anything on television about going to school, it's always a finely dressed young man or woman sitting behind a perfectly clean desk with a laptop. There's nothing ever said about the trades. There's nothing what as a career. Going into welding or machinist or, you know, but trucking is something. I used to train young drivers over the road, And they were, a lot of them were very surprised at how much you had to know, the hours and everything. They were like, well, I just thought this was going to be easy. And a lot of them dropped out. Not many stuck with it.
You have to do a lot of navigating. Oh, I'm so glad you called. Mike, you want to respond to David?
Oh, my God. I have so many responses. Mm-hmm. He should have thrown the Wall Street Journal back at his brother. Mm. Said, I already know what's in there. Well, he touches on so many themes that are important, right? I mean, first of all, the meaning that work can have to you, and that's going to differ person by person. He obviously found a kind of work that has great meaning to him and also enabled David to do really well. As he said, you know, he put his wife through school, he put kids through school, and it's been a job that's been consistent for him. When a lot of white-collar workers over the last 10 or 15 years have been finding themselves put in the very terrible spot that their work is being broken down, digitized, and outsourced, right? So,
right.
Dave, I thought David just touched on so many things, from the kind of bias that we were talking about earlier to the meaning that work can have for you to the fact that the kind of work that he did, that he does, driving truck, is able to provide a really solid living for him and his family.
Right. And obviously has a lot of meaning for that very reason. And that's another thing that you get to time and time again. What we do has great meaning in our lives, doesn't it? All we had to do was to give our phone line, Mike, and our phones were just lit up. People want to talk about what it is they do.
Yeah. Yeah. I found that with so much, when the book first came out and I was doing these kinds of shows, I open up the new preface by talking about all mm-hmm. different kinds of responses that I got. And people really do want to tell the story of their work or tell the story of their forebears' work, right? I think work really touches something in this country.
Thank you, David. Carry on. Nice to hear from you. Mary in Baraboo. Hi.
Hi. The first thing I want to say is when you mentioned Working by Studs Terkel, it made me smile because my son several years ago did a small piece from working for his forensic solo acting. So I thought that
great.
Was kind of neat.
Great. That's
but
great.
But I wanted to say what I do is I work in a convenience store. Customer service to me is of the utmost, and I think you have to use your brain and your observations and everything else. Now, the young kids that come to work there, it's a stepping point. It's just a stepping stone to send them to college, which is fine. But the one thing I have is I know that I help some people because they're lonely, and maybe I'm the only person they talk to all day because some of the elderly don't have anyone to talk to. Plus the fact that I have got, because of the company I work for, I have got great job security, and I doubt if these young kids will go to college, come out, and be able to say that they know their job is going to be there next year and the year after and the year after that because it's an excellent company. So I don't think everybody looks real highly on convenience store worker because we haven't been to school, but I think that, you know, we're the ones that are there Christmas and New Year's and 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and so I think what I do is important, and even though other people might not. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary, for calling.
Boy, Mary really, she touches on something terribly important there, and I talk about it a little bit, too. And that's that workers are part of the social fabric. I mean, I was really touched when she talked about the fact that some of the people who come in to see her, she may be the only human contact that they have during the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so her interaction with them, her kind of reading their mood and interacting with them, helping them with something, any and all of that, she becomes part of the social fabric of that little neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just hugely important, and we don't think about that very much when we think about folks who, as she was saying, you know, are checkers in the market or tellers in a bank or work in a convenience store. They're part of the social world for some people. Very important.
Yeah. I mean, for all of us, I can remember times when nobody's been around in my life, family's been gone, or before I had family, when that was important to me, too, to go to a grocery store and have a conversation with somebody or go to the library. It would be human contact is, in addition to work, is something that is very important in our lives.
It hugely is. And I think especially in larger cities, we can really get disconnected from that.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your call. Jeffrey in De Pere, hi. Hi, Jeffrey.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
All right. Hi. Thanks. I'm just taking the dogs for a walk.
Okay.
As soon as I heard about the book and listened to your show, I just wanted to, well, basically, I've been paying taxes since I was 15 years old and working 44 years. 17 years as a truck driver, which is very physical and mentally demanding because in 1984, it was no power steering, no air conditioning, and everything was a hand-on load. And as time went by, trailers got bigger. Cities didn't get smaller. They got tighter. From a 45-foot trailer to a 48 to a 53.
Mm.
And loads then became palletized, or you could hire somebody to, a lumper, to unload your trailer at a food warehouse. And then you would lose your money because you didn't unload it, but you weren't so physically exhausted when you were done.
Mm-hmm.
At 12 years as a corrections officer, and that was more mentally demanding than it was physical, but it could be physically demanding. Either way, the money was pretty decent as a truck driver, 24 cents a mile, $9.50 an hour in 1984. Department of Corrections, $10.50 an hour, up to $18 when I retired.
Mm.
Now I'm a janitor. And it's both physically and mentally demanding to get your work done in a period of time and to put up with people's ignorance. No disrespect, but you're mopping the floor, you're trying to keep it safe, and they walk right through your, you know, when you just clean up the soda, but they didn't step, they didn't fall. But I really appreciate your program, and thanks for taking the time to listen to me.
Oh, I appreciate your calling in. Thank you, Jeffrey. These calls are just, they're just wonderful, aren't they? Things we, people hadn't thought of. See, I never thought of that. Walking in, that people walk in somebody's space where he obviously went to the trouble of cleaning up the soda and it says, do not walk. Oh, my.
I can imagine that infuriated him.
Right.
Interesting man, right? He had three very different kinds of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Spend some time, because there are so many of these and there will only be more as we get older, and we're getting older in this country. The people who are doing home health care work, oh, it is so crucial and it is so difficult, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I'm sure this is true for a lot of our listeners and maybe for you, Kathleen, that this becomes very personal to me because both of my folks and my stepfather, you know, we had to use home health care workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I got to see this up close. There's so many of them in the United States as we age. And, you know, many of them are working minimum wage or less. A lot of them work off the books. Some of them certainly get a bum deal at their work. You know, that we read these stories all the time of folks not getting paid or getting underpaid or people fooling around with their contracts or not having a contract. It's very demanding work, physically very demanding, but it also calls on so many social skills to do it well. I was just so struck by the woman who worked with my stepfather up until he died a couple years ago. She was magnificent with old folks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was just gifted. She could understand him when I couldn't. She sensed his moods. She kept him happy. She was vigilant. She was just terrific, as well as being physically adroit, as you have to be doing that kind of work. So I have tremendous respect for folks who do that kind of labor.
And yet we look at how much money those workers are making and how crucial they are and the huge disparity. What do we do about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, different states are trying to do some things. I don't know what's going on in Wisconsin. I know that here in California, there's been some legislation that has been moving through the state legislature to try and you know, up their wages or give them some kinds of minimal benefits or assurances. Because as I say, a good deal of them work for companies that, you know, are unscrupulous. And so, and as I say, then also some don't work for companies at all. They work, you know, on their own, and mm-hmm. they can get taken advantage of as well. So I think there are attempts in some states to try to regulate and provide some kinds of protections for those workers.
Let's go to John next. Hi, John.
Yes, hello there. I just wanted to share an anecdote. I once had a physician tell me that the person he admired most was his mechanic. Because the way he described it, he says, in my line of work, my patients only come in two models, and they're both from the same manufacturer.
Mechanics. Those jobs, I don't know how people can do that. My mind doesn't work that way at all. But you have to have a mind that is pretty intricate to be able to store all that information and figure things out, Mike.
Yeah, I think it's the troubleshooting that really impresses me. It's like you say, figuring things out. You know, and of course, a lot of this stuff has gotten more and more computerized. I mean, you know, you've seen it, right? You open up the hood of your car now, and it looks completely different than, you know, the 85 Dodge that you used to have. So mechanics these days also have to be pretty adroit with computers and other kinds of electrical equipment. But yeah, the problem solving, troubleshooting stuff really impresses me. Being able to kind of follow something through and go through a series of steps in your mind, trying to rule certain things out. When you see a good mechanic at work, it's pretty impressive.
Thanks, John, so much for your call. Nancy in Janesville. Hi. Nancy, are you there? I'm sorry, Nancy. I just heard you as I was saying goodbye. So please call us again. 800-486-8655. Carol in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say something that regarding like the trucker that just called. Some of them probably have no idea that there are some of us who watch them make those maneuvers and are just absolutely in awe as to how in the world they do it. If you can, have you ever tried to back up a little child's wagon where you're pushing on the handle end and it's hard to control which way it's going to go? Can you imagine what it's like with a big, long trailer having to back that precisely into a space? And I've watched them, you know, in where they don't have much working room because it's a tight space behind a building off of a small, short, you know, just a two-lane road. And they'll back into a slot and dock just perfectly into the truck dock. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to do that. I can't see how these guys can do that. They're pushing this big, long, awkwardly balanced thing, and they get it right where they need it. I've actually sat and watched them do it. And they probably wondered if maybe I was trying to get by or something, and I was just watching because I thought, I couldn't do that. That's amazing. And I think maybe a lot of them don't realize how some of us think that what they do is really quite astonishing.
I'm sure that many truckers appreciate it.
I've had the same experience. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No. I was just going to say I've had the same experience Carol has had, where I just sit there astounded, because the other thing is they make it look so effortless, right? Mm-hmm. It really amazes me how they manipulate those big rigs, the turns and the backing up and all that sort of thing. Truck driving was not one of the occupations that I spent a lot of time on. But after it was published, I got a call from a guy who ran a large trucking company, and he told me that if I ever wanted to, I could go on some of these rides with these fellows.
Oh, that'd be fun, Mike.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to be able to see that from the inside and to just kind of watch and get a sense of all that's involved in the kind of manipulation that Carol's talking about, that, as I said, just seem so effortless when they do it, but it is pretty awe-inspiring.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Mike's heard from a lot of people. His book, The Mind at Work, has a new preface. It's now in its 10th anniversary edition. It includes the working life of a waitress, styling hair, the intelligence of plumbing, a vocabulary of carpentry, electrical wiring and construction, a welder and a foreman, rethinking hand and brain, and the paradox of vocational education. And then he writes about the working life. So that's what the book encompasses. But he hears from people who do all kinds of work on programs like this. So that's good. More phone calls momentarily. Carol, thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave messages there. We had the best Facebook page day yesterday because people, we were talking about with a large animal vet, and you posted pictures of your goats and your cows and laughing horses and even snakes. It was just terrific. And KP's going to put all of those in a folder eventually so we can sort through anytime you're feeling a little down. You can look at some of these animals, piglets, baby piglets. Oh, it was good. It was so good. So you can leave messages today about your jobs, which would be, it'd be great. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to talk just a little bit before we go back to our many calls, Mike, about school. You talk about, and you've taught at all levels too, a significant amount of teaching you've written, often informal and indirect, takes place at work. That's certainly true in my profession and in learning the radio business. I didn't learn it at school. I learned it by doing radio. I would think that is true of so many jobs, and if it's something we're overlooking.
Yeah, there is so much teaching that goes on. I think the first caller was David, the long-haul trucker. And remember he mentioned something about one of the things he did was train young drivers. And that kind of thing goes on, well, formally it goes on with apprenticeship programs, but informally it goes on all the time where young workers are learning tricks of the trade from folks who have been around a lot longer. And in some fields, that's hugely important because there's danger involved. So in construction, for example, you know, a young person just being able to learn all the kinds of, the tricks of the trade, the cautions, the things to look out for, the weird things that can happen, all of that, that kind of training that happens formally or informally is just a huge part of what occurs on a work crew.
So what is the place of vocational school, tech schools? Are they good things?
Right. So vocational education is a complicated story in itself. You know, we've had it as a formal part of schooling since the beginning of the 20th century. And you and I talked a little while ago about tracking and, you know, the different curricular tracks. So those have been fairly dismantled, although people still tend to slot in, you know, by social class into some tracks more than others. But the interesting thing about the history of vocational education is that it actually didn't do a very good job of doing what it was supposed to do, which is to prepare people for work. I mean, there's reports that were starting in the 40s and 50s from businesses, for example, saying that, you know, some of the young people coming out of those programs weren't really prepared for the jobs that they were trained for. And then the other thing that happened was what you and I were referring to, and that is this kind of rigid tracking where people were slotted to go in one direction in life rather than another. Now, there's been a lot of attempts to reform occupational and vocational education, both at the high school and community college level, and there have been some important changes. I think people are in some places, some schools really trying to amp up the naturally occurring intellectual content of vocational education and are trying to make it more, you know, a pathway into a good and decent job. To do that, you really do have to amp up the academic side of things because, as we've been saying, work is filled with intellectual content. So it's been a mixed bag vocational education, but when it's done right, I think it can be a powerful, can lead to a powerful kind of education.
Let's go to Daryl in Bloomington next. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hello. I started as a farmer, and then I went out to California. I was going to major in broadcasting, but I ended up selling insurance out there and came back and went to Oklahoma City and got involved in apartment maintenance where you fix every kind of appliance you can think of. You have to troubleshoot it and repair it. And then I got into air conditioning, and then I became a contractor and a technician in air conditioning. And in air conditioning, you have unbelievable amounts of different combinations of trouble that can cause a problem that you have to be able to trace down. And I also am on forums on the Internet now teaching ordinary consumers how to they can figure out by doing a few simple tests the performance of their air conditioning systems. And in the Southwest, South, and different places, we're subsidizing the air conditioning electrical use. It's the Home Energy Assistance Program that they have going. And we, the air conditioning mechanics need some special training because 59% to 63% is all the BTU performance that we get out of even new installations. And we have to change that so we can transition to renewable energy. And all I'm about is problem solving. And we need to have core problem solvers, irrespective of whether they have college degrees or what level of education they have attained. I studied broadcasting in college, but it never taught what I teach the potential of broadcasting has. And that communication potential to reach everybody around the world is the only way we're ever going to meet the changing climate situation and a lot of these problems we have. And I did a post 2 hours in advance of your programming on the way I would have led this program as far as an interviewer goes.
All right. Thank you, Daryl, very much for the call. He's been a man of many traits.
Boy, no kidding. Talk about fusing. He combines two of the more unusual, I mean, it's an unusual combination, right? What he's doing now is combining his broadcasting talents with his air conditioning and expertise. But he said something that really struck me, and that is I think as you dig deep into a lot of different kinds of work, you find just how much problem solving is involved. I mean, sure, a lot of things are routine. You know, a plumber comes out to clear your drain. That's a routine thing. That plumber does it, you know, every day. But even with routine, stuff goes wrong, or you encounter something that's a little odd, or pipes have settled in a particular way. You know, there's always the potential of a wrinkle, and it's how well the person handles that wrinkle that shows their expertise, how well they think it through and then try and figure out how to solve the problem when the problem suddenly becomes a little more complicated than I thought it was going to be.
Right. Thank you, Daryl, for your call. Nancy in Janesville. Hi. Nancy, are you there? Marcus in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. Yeah, I initially called up. I was going to tell you about my construction career. It was about 20 years long, and I worked for this one outfit, and we traveled all around the state. And it was a specialized bit of construction, and I learned as I went on, it was not just a skill, but it was almost an art. What we did, you know, in order to be good and fast, and we did neat things, aerial, you know, scaffolding on old buildings and stuff. And anyway, and I want to tell you, when I worked in California in the service industry, I went out there when I was 17, and I worked in a restaurant near Disneyland. And one thing I'll never forget, I was a busboy, and so I learned, you know, the people out there thought that we had a good work ethic, you know, from the Midwest, but, you know, I had pep in my step or whatever and a good personality. And some guy came up to me and gave me a half dollar. A real shiny half dollar, and I said to him, I can't accept tips, you know, I have to give that to the waitress or something. And he put it in my smock, and as he was handing it to me, he said, you know, he said, I've been watching you,
And he said, I want you to have this. And then that's when I said, I can't take it. So that must have really made an impression on me, because I always knew in all my jobs that it's not just the boss watching you or the results, but people on the job site, and this and that, people that matter, people that don't matter, whatever. But you're always kind of being watched, you know. And I always, it's not like that was a dominant thing in my brain or anything, but I just always, and I got a lot of compliments throughout my career about that, that really stuck with me, that, you know, it's if you enjoy your job and, you know, you clean up good afterwards. And, you know, I think that makes a big difference when people can see that you get into what you're doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that really made an effect on me. It helped me a lot through my career, and it got me this last job I had. I found out that the owners were watching me do some yard work, and they hired me on the spot. You know, it's pretty weird. But so, yeah, I mean, it makes a big difference of how you conduct yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Marcus, so much. I like that. He had a pep in his step. Makes a big difference to have that, doesn't it, Mike?
Well, and you know, he touches on something that's so important, and that is being acknowledged for doing something.
Yes,
well.
Yes, right, right. How true.
Huge.
Mm-hmm.
I had some guys putting in a washer and dryer here, and, you know, mine was the first of many stops. And they were really good, Kathleen,
mm-hmm.
figuring out how to get this stuff into a short space,
mm-hmm.
blah, and all that. So anyway, they're finished. And I just said to the guy, I said, man, I want to tell you, you guys are really good. And the guy looked at me and said, you know, people treat us like mules. And I was so struck by that.
Right.
I mean, how rare it must have been for him to have just somebody say, geez, you guys are good.
Mm-hmm.
It really matters.
Mm-hmm. It does really matter, and we don't say that enough to people who do so many things. Marcus's story will stay with me, too. And it stayed with him. Is look at that, his whole life, that somebody did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important. Thanks, Marcus, very much for your call. All right, let's go next to Bill in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Bill.
Hi, excuse me. Hi there.
Hi.
There are so many things I'd like to comment about this program has shared, but I am a retired tool and die maker. My wife is a physician's assistant in the hospital. And the thing I remember bothering me the most, and I see it happening in her field as well, is the people in the corporation or company higher up decide that they're going to do something, make a change, supposedly to improve things. But they do so seldom do they contact people that are going to be doing the work with this so-called improvement to ask what would help them.
Mm-hmm.
What would this be a problem if we changed it to that? They don't often enough go to the people that are going to be using the tool.
Yeah, and doesn't that happen in so many professions? We have about 45 seconds, Mike Rose.
Yeah, boy, Bill, it's a good way to end, actually. Then that is, he's pointing out that both in business but also in public policy, so often folks at a very high level who don't have on-the-ground experience of the work make these policies, make these changes, and they're made in ignorance, really, of the way the work actually progresses.
Mm-hmm.
And it can have some disastrous results.
Mm. Well, aren't you the perfect Labor Day guest? This has been great. Thank you so much for being with us, Mike.
Oh, gosh. Thanks to you, Kathleen, and thanks to your callers, a terrific bunch of callers.
Aren't they? I know. They
yeah.
really are.
Yeah.
They're great. Thanks, Mike. Mike Rose, our guest this hour. Mike is the author. This book is now in its 10th anniversary edition. It has a new preface. The stories, of course, are ageless because they're about workers, and it's about the mind at work, valuing the intelligence of the American worker. Mike Rose is the author, and Mike has done many things. He's been mostly in education for the past 40 years. He has taught in everything from kindergarten to he's taught job training, adult literacy programs. He's on the faculty right now of the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, and he is a prolific author. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this perfect Labor Day show. KP is a good worker. And thanks to Lisa Nalbandian, who's a good worker as well, for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Have a good Labor Day.